The finite, infinite distinction matters. In the finite case, for example, as we consider the cosmos at ever earlier times, it's accurate to picture the entirety of space continually shrinking. Although the mathematics breaks down at time zero itself, it's correct to envision that at moments ever closer to time zero, the universe is an ever smaller speck. For the infinite case, however, this description is wrong. If space is truly infinite in size, then it always has been and always will be. When it shrinks, its contents are squeezed ever closer together, making the density of matter ever larger. But its overall extent remains infinite. After all, shrink an infinite tabletop by a factor of 2, and what do you get? Half of infinity, which is still infinite. Shrink by a factor of 1,000,000, and what do you get? Infinity still. The closer to time zero you consider an infinite universe, the denser it becomes at every location, but its spatial extent remains unending. Although observations leave the finite versus infinite issue undecided, I found that when pressed, physicists and cosmologists tend to favor the proposition that the universe is infinite. Partly, I think this view is rooted in the historical happenstance that for many decades, researchers paid little heed to the finite video game shape, mostly because it is more mathematically complex to analyze. Perhaps the view also reflects a common misconception that the difference between an infinite and a huge but finite universe is a cosmological distinction that's only of academic interest. After all, if space is so large that you will only ever have access to a small portion of its entirety, should you care whether it extends for a finite or for an infinite distance beyond what you can see? You should. The issue of whether space is finite or infinite has a profound impact on the very nature of reality, which takes us to the heart of this chapter. Let's now consider the possibility of an infinitely big cosmos and explore its implications. With minimal effort, we'll find ourselves inhabiting one of an infinite collection of parallel worlds. Infinite space and a patchwork quilt. Let's start simply. Back here on Earth, far from the vast reaches of an infinite cosmic expanse, imagine that your friend Imelda, to satisfy her penchant for variety in personal attire, has acquired 500 richly embroidered dresses and 1,000 pairs of designer shoes. If each day she wears one dress with one pair of shoes, at some point she will exhaust all possible combinations and duplicate an earlier outfit. It's easy to figure out when. 500 dresses and 1,000 pairs of shoes yield 500,000 different combinations. 500,000 days is about 1,400 years. So if she lived long enough, Imelda would be seen in an outfit she'd already worn. If Imelda, blessed with infinite longevity, continued to cycle through every possible combination, she'd necessarily don each of her outfits an infinite number of times. An infinite number of appearances with a finite number of outfits ensures infinite repetition. Pursuing the same theme, imagine that Randy, an expert card dealer, has shuffled a gargantuan number of decks, one by one, and neatly stacked each next to the others. Can the order of cards in every shuffled deck be different, or must they repeat? The answer depends on the number of decks. 52 cards can be arranged in about 10 to the 68 different ways. 52 possibilities for which card will be the first, times 51 remaining possibilities for which will be the second, times 50 remaining possibilities for the next card, and so on. If the number of decks Randy shuffles exceeds the number of different possible card orderings, then some of the shuffled decks would match. If Randy were to shuffle an infinite number of decks, the orderings of the cards would necessarily repeat an infinite number of times. As with Imelda and her outfits, an infinite number of occurrences with a finite number of possible configurations ensures that outcomes are infinitely repeated. This basic notion is of the essence for cosmology in an infinite universe. Two key steps show why. In an infinite universe, most regions lie beyond our ability to see, even using the most powerful telescopes possible. Although light travels enormously quickly, if an object is sufficiently distant, then the light it emits, even light that may have been emitted shortly after the Big Bang, will simply not have had sufficient time to reach us. Since the universe is about 13.7 billion years old, you might think that anything farther away than 13.7 billion light years would fall into this category. The reasoning behind this intuition is right on target, but the expansion of space increases the distance to objects whose light has long been traveling and has only just been received. So the maximum distance we can see is actually longer, about 41 billion light years. But the exact numbers hardly matter. The important point is that regions of the universe beyond a certain distance are regions currently beyond our observational reach. Much as ships that have sailed beyond the horizon are not visible to someone standing on the shore, astronomers say that objects in space that are too far away to be seen lie beyond our cosmic horizon. Similarly, the light we've been emitting can't yet have reached those distant regions, so we are beyond their cosmic horizon. And it's not that cosmic horizons solely delineate what someone can and cannot see. From Einstein's special relativity, we know that no signal, no disturbance, no information, no anything can travel faster than light. Which means that regions of the universe so far apart the light hasn't had time to travel between them are regions that have never exchanged any influence of any kind, and so have evolved completely independently. Using a two-dimensional analogy, we can compare the expanse of space at a given moment of time to a giant patchwork quilt with circular patches in which each patch represents a single cosmic horizon. Someone located in the center of a patch can have interacted with anything that lies in the same patch, but has had no contact with anything lying in a different patch because they're too far away. Points lying near the border between two patches are closer than the respective centers, and so can have interacted. But if we consider, say, patches in every other row and every other column of the cosmic quilt, all points residing in different patches are now so far from one another that no cross-patch interactions of any kind could have taken place. The same idea applies in three dimensions, where the cosmic horizons, the patches in the cosmic quilt, are spherical, and the same conclusion holds. Sufficiently distant patches lie beyond one another's spheres of influence, and so are independent realms. If space is large but finite, we can divide it into a large but finite number of such independent patches. If space is infinite, then there are an infinite number of independent patches. It's this latter possibility that's of particular allure, and the second part of the argument tells why. As we will now see, in a given patch, the particles of matter, more precisely matter and all forms of energy, can be arranged in only a finite number of different configurations. Using the reasoning rehearsed with Imelda and Randy, this means that conditions in the infinity of far-flung patches, in regions of space like the one we inhabit, but distributed through a limitless cosmos, necessarily repeat. Finite possibilities. Imagine it's a hot summer night, and there's an annoying fly buzzing around your bedroom. You've tried the swatter, you've tried the nasty spray. Nothing's worked. In desperation, you try reason. "This is a big bedroom," you tell the fly. "There are so many other places you could be. There's no reason to keep buzzing around my ear." "Really?" the fly slyly counters. "How many places are there?" In a classical universe, the answer is infinitely many. As you tell the fly, he, or more precisely his center of mass, could move 3 meters to the left, or 2.5 meters to the right, or 2.236 meters up, or 1.195829 meters down, or you get the idea. Since the fly's position can vary continuously, there are infinitely many places it can be. In fact, as you explain all this to the fly, you realize that not only does position present the fly with infinite variety, but so does velocity. At one moment, the fly can be here, heading to the right at 1 kilometer per hour. Or it might be heading to the left at 0.5 kilometer per hour, or heading up at 1/4 kilometer per hour, or heading down at 0.349283 kilometers per hour, and so on. Although the fly's speed is constrained by a number of factors, including the limited energy it possesses, since the faster it flies, the more energy it needs to expend, it can vary continuously and hence provides another source of infinite variety. The fly isn't convinced. I'm with you when you talk about moving a centimeter or a half a centimeter or even 1/4 centimeter, the fly responds. But when you speak of locations that differ by 1/10,000th or 1/100,000th of a centimeter or even less, you've lost me. To an egghead, those might be different locations, but it flies in the face of experience to say that here and 1/1,000,000th of a centimeter to the left of here are really different. I can't sense such a tiny change in location, and so I don't count them as different places. Same goes for speed. I can tell the difference between going 1 kilometer per hour and going at 1/2 that rate, but the difference between 0.25 kilometers per hour and 0.24999999999 kilometers per hour? Please. Only a wise fly would claim to be able to tell the difference. Fact is, none of us can. So as far as I'm concerned, those are the same speeds. There's far less variety available than you're describing. The fly has raised an important point. In principle, he can occupy an infinite variety of positions and attain an infinite variety of speeds. But in any practical sense, there is a limit to how fine the differences in location and speed can be before they go completely unnoticed. This is true even if the fly employs the best of equipment. There is always a limit on how small an increment in position or speed can be and yet still register. And regardless of how fine those minimal increments are, if they're not zero, they radically reduce the range of possible experience. For instance, if the smallest increments that can be detected are 1/100 of a centimeter, then each centimeter offers not an infinite number of detectably different locations, but only 100. Each cubic centimeter would thus provide 100 cubed, or 1,000,000, different locations, and your average bedroom would offer about 100 trillion. Whether the fly would find this array of options sufficiently impressive to keep away from your ear is difficult to say. The conclusion, though, is that anything but measurements with perfect resolution reduces the number of possibilities from infinite to finite. You might counter that the inability to distinguish between tiny spatial separations or differences in speed reflects nothing more than a technological limitation. With progress, the precision of equipment always improves, so the number of discernibly distinct positions and speeds available to a well-funded fly will always increase. Here, I must invoke some basic quantum theory. According to quantum mechanics, there's a precise sense in which there is a fundamental limit on how accurate particular measurements can be, and this limit can't ever be surpassed, regardless of technological progress, ever. The limit arises from a central feature of quantum mechanics, the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle establishes that regardless of what equipment you use or what techniques you employ, if you increase the resolution of your measurement of one property, there is an unavoidable cost. You necessarily reduce how accurately you can measure a complementary property. As a prime example, the uncertainty principle shows that the more accurately you measure an object's position, the less accurately you can measure its speed, and vice versa. From the perspective of classical physics, the physics that informs much of our intuition about how the world works, this limitation is completely foreign. But as a rough analogy, think about photographing that impish fly. If your shutter speed is high, you'll get a sharp image that records the fly's location at the moment you snap the picture. But because the photo is crisp, the fly appears motionless. The image gives no information about the fly's speed. If you set your shutter speed low, The resulting blurry image will convey something of the fly's motion, but because of that very blurriness, it also provides an imprecise measurement of the fly's location. You can't take a photo that gives sharp information about position and speed simultaneously. Using the mathematics of quantum mechanics, Werner Heisenberg provided a precise limit on how imprecise the combined measurements of position and speed necessarily are. This inescapable imprecision is what quantum physicists mean by uncertainty. For our purpose, there's a particularly useful way of framing his result. Much as a sharper photograph requires that you use a higher shutter speed, Heisenberg's math shows that a sharper measurement of an object's position requires that you use a higher energy probe. Turn on your bedside lamp, and the resulting probe, diffuse, low-energy light, allows you to make out the general shape of the fly's legs and eyes. Illuminate him with higher energy photons, like X-rays, keeping the photon burst short to avoid cooking him, and the finer resolution reveals the minuscule muscles that flap the fly's wings. But perfect resolution, according to Heisenberg, requires a probe with infinite energy. That's unattainable. And so the essential conclusion is at hand. Classical physics makes clear that perfect resolution is unattainable in practice. Quantum physics goes further and establishes that perfect resolution is unattainable in principle. If you imagine both the speed and the position of an object, be it a fly or an electron, changing by sufficiently small amounts, then according to quantum mechanics, you are imagining something meaningless. Changes that are too small to be measured, even in principle, are not changes at all. By the same reasoning we used in our pre-quantum analysis of the fly, the limit on resolution reduces from infinite to finite the number of distinct possibilities for an object's position and speed. And since the limited resolution entailed by quantum mechanics is entwined in the very fibers of physical law, this reduction to finite possibilities is unavoidable and unassailable. Cosmic repetition. So much for flies in bedrooms. Now consider a larger region of space. Consider a region the size of today's cosmic horizon, a sphere with a radius of 41 billion light years. A region, that is, which is the size of a single patch in the cosmic quilt. And consider filling it not with a single fly, but with particles of matter and radiation. Here's the question. How many different arrangements of the particles are possible? Well, as with a box of Legos, the more pieces you have, the more matter and radiation you cram into the region, the greater the number of possible arrangements. But you can't cram pieces in indefinitely. Particles carry energy, so more particles means more energy. If a region of space contains too much energy, it will collapse under its own weight and form a black hole. And if after a black hole forms, you try to cram yet more matter and energy into the region, the black hole's boundary, its so-called event horizon, will grow larger, encompassing more space. There is thus a limit to how much matter and energy can exist fully within a region of space of a given size. For a region of space as large as today's cosmic horizon, the limits involved are huge, about 10 to the 56 grams. But the size of the limit is not central. What's central is that there is a limit. Finite energy within a cosmic horizon entails a finite number of particles, be they electrons, protons, neutrons, neutrinos, muons, photons, or any of the other known or as yet unidentified species in the particle bestiary. Finite energy within a cosmic horizon also entails that each of these particles, like the annoying fly in your bedroom, has a finite number of distinct possible locations and speeds. Collectively, a finite number of particles, each of which can have finitely many distinct positions and velocities, means that within any cosmic horizon, only a finite number of different particle arrangements are available. In the more refined language of quantum theory proper, which we'll encounter in Chapter 8, we don't speak of particle positions and velocities per se, but rather of the quantum state of these particles. From this perspective, we would say there are only a finite number of observably distinct quantum states for the particles in the cosmic patch. Indeed, a short calculation reveals that the number of distinct possible particle configurations within a cosmic horizon is about 10 to the 10 to the 122. That's a 1 followed by 10 to the 122 zeros. This is a huge, but decidedly finite number. The limited number of different closed combinations ensures that, with enough outings, Imelda's attire will necessarily repeat. The limited number of different card orderings ensures that, with enough decks, Randy's shuffles will necessarily repeat. By the same reasoning, the limited number of particle arrangements ensures that, with enough patches in the cosmic quilt, enough independent cosmic horizons, the particle arrangements, when compared from patch to patch, must somewhere repeat. Even if you were able to play Cosmic Designer and try to arrange each patch to be different from the ones you'd examined before, with a big enough expanse, you'd eventually run out of distinct designs and would be forced to repeat a previous arrangement. In an infinitely big universe, the repetition is yet more extreme. There are infinitely many patches in an infinite expanse of space. So, with only finitely many different particle arrangements, the arrangements of particles within patches must be duplicated an infinite number of times. That's the result we've been after. Nothing but physics. In interpreting the implications of this statement, I should declare my bias. I believe that a physical system is completely determined by the arrangement of its particles. Tell me how the particles making up the Earth, the Sun, the galaxy, and everything else are arranged, and you've fully articulated reality. This reductionist view is common among physicists, but there are certainly people who think otherwise, especially when it comes to life. Some believe that an essential non-physical aspect, spirit, soul, life force, chi, and so on, is required to animate the physical. Although I remain open to this possibility, I've never encountered any evidence to support it. The position that makes the most sense to me is that one's physical and mental characteristics are nothing but a manifestation of how the particles in one's body are arranged. Specify the particle arrangement, and you've specified everything. Adhering to this perspective, we conclude that if the particle arrangements with which we're familiar were duplicated in another patch, another cosmic horizon, that patch would look and feel like ours in every way. This means that if the universe is infinite in extent, you are not alone in whatever reaction you are now having to this view of reality. There are many perfect copies of you out there in the cosmos feeling exactly the same way. And there's no way to say which is really you. All versions are physically and hence mentally identical. We can even estimate the distance to the nearest copy. If the particle arrangements are randomly distributed from patch to patch, an assumption that's compatible with the refined cosmological theory we will encounter in the next chapter, then we can expect that the conditions in our patch will be duplicated as frequently as those in any other. In every collection of 10 to the 10 to the 122 cosmic patches, we thus expect there to be, on average, one patch that looks just like ours. That is, in every region of space that's roughly 10 to the 10 to the 122 meters across, there should be a cosmic patch that replicates ours, one that contains you, the Earth, the galaxy, and everything else that inhabits our cosmic horizon. If you lower your sights and don't seek an exact replica of our entire cosmic horizon, but would be satisfied with an exact copy of a region a few light years in radius and centered on our sun, the order is more easily filled. On average, in every region that's about 10 to the 10 to the 100 meters across, you should find one such copy. Still easier to find are approximate copies. After all, there is only one way to duplicate a region exactly, but many ways to almost duplicate it. Were you to visit these inexact copies, you'd find that some are barely distinguishable from ours. while in others the differences would range from obvious to exhilarating to shocking. Every decision you've ever made is tantamount to a particular particle arrangement. If you turned left, your particles went one way. If you turned right, your particles went the other. If you said yes, the particles in your brain, lips, and vocal cords proceeded through one pattern. If you said no, they proceeded through a different pattern. And so every possible action, every choice you've made, and every option you've discarded will be played out in one patch or another. In sum, your worst fears about yourself, your family, and life on Earth have been realized. In others, your wildest dreams have come to pass. In others still, the differences arising from the close but distinct particle arrangements have combined to yield an unrecognizable environment. And in most patches, the particle complexion would not include the highly specialized arrangements we recognize as living organisms, so the patches would be lifeless, or at least devoid of life as we know it. Over time, the size of the cosmic patches will increase. With more time, light can travel farther, and so each of the cosmic horizons will grow larger. Ultimately, the cosmic horizons will overlap. And when they do, the regions can no longer be considered as separate and isolated. The parallel universes will no longer be parallel. They will have merged. Nevertheless, the result we found will continue to hold. Just lay out a new grid of cosmic patches, with patch size set by the distance light can have traveled since the Big Bang through this later moment. The patches will be bigger, so their centers will need to be farther apart. But with infinite space at our disposal, there's ample room to accommodate this adjustment. And so we've come to a conclusion that's both general and provocative. Reality in an infinite cosmos is not what most of us would expect. At any moment in time, the expanse of space contains an infinite number of separate realms, constituents of what I'll call the quilted multiverse. With our observable universe, all we see in the vast night sky being but one member. Canvassing this infinite collection of separate realms, we find that particle arrangements necessarily repeat infinitely many times. The reality that holds in any given universe, including ours, is thus replicated in an infinite number of other universes across the quilted multiverse. What to make of this? It's possible that the conclusion we've reached strikes you as so outlandish that you're inclined to turn the discussion on its head. You might argue that the bizarre nature of where we've gotten, infinite copies of you and everyone and everything, is evidence of the faulty nature of one or more of the assumptions that led us here. Might the assumption that the entire cosmos is inhabited by particles be wrong? Perhaps beyond our cosmic horizon is a vast realm containing nothing but empty space. It's possible, but the theoretical contortions required to accommodate such a picture render it thoroughly unconvincing. The most refined cosmological theories, to be encountered shortly, don't lead us anywhere near this possibility. Might the very laws of physics change beyond our cosmic horizon, corrupting our ability to perform any reliable theoretical analyses of those distant realms? Again, it's possible. But as we will see in the next chapter, recent developments yield a compelling argument that although the laws can vary, that variation doesn't invalidate our conclusions regarding the quilted multiverse. Might the universe's spatial expanse be finite? Sure. Definitely possible. If space were finite yet large enough, there could still be some interesting patches way out there. But a smallish finite universe could easily fail to have adequate space to accommodate substantial numbers of distinct patches, let alone any that are duplicates of our own. A finite universe poses the most convincing way to upend the quilted multiverse. But in the last few decades, physicists working to push the Big Bang theory back to time zero in search of a deeper understanding of the origin and nature of Lemaitre's primeval atom have developed an approach called inflationary cosmology. In the inflationary framework, the argument in support of an infinitely large cosmos not only garners strong observational and theoretical support, but, as we will see, becomes an almost inevitable conclusion. What's more, inflation brings to the fore another, even more exotic variety of parallel worlds. Chapter 3. Eternity and Infinity, the Inflationary Multiverse. A pioneering group of physicists in the mid-1900s realized that if you were to shut off the sun, remove the other stars from the Milky Way, and even sweep away the more distant galaxies, space would not be black. To the human eye, it would appear black, but if you could see radiation in the microwave part of the spectrum, then every which way you turned, you'd see a uniform glow. Its origin? The origin. Remarkably, these physicists discovered a pervasive sea of microwave radiation filling space that is a present-day relic of the universe's creation. The story of this breakthrough recounts a phenomenal achievement of the Big Bang theory, but in time it also revealed one of the theory's fundamental shortcomings and thus set the stage for the next major breakthrough in cosmology after the pioneering works of Friedmann and Lemaître, the inflationary theory. Inflationary cosmology modifies the Big Bang theory by inserting an intense burst of enormously fast expansion during the universe's earliest moments. This modification, as we will see, proves essential to explaining some otherwise perplexing features of the relic radiation. But more than that, inflationary cosmology is a key chapter in our story because scientists have gradually realized over the last few decades that the most convincing versions of the theory yield a vast collection of parallel universes, radically transforming the complexion of reality. Relics of a Hot Beginning. George Gamow, a hulking 6'3" Russian physicist known for important contributions to quantum and nuclear physics in the early 20th century, was as quick-witted and fun-loving as he was hard-living. In 1932, he and his wife tried to defect from the Soviet Union by paddling across the Black Sea in a kayak, stocked with a healthy assortment of chocolate and brandy. When bad weather sent the two scurrying back to shore, Gamma was able to fast-talk the authorities with a tale of the unfortunately failed scientific experiments he'd been undertaking at sea. In the 1940s, after having successfully slipped past the Iron Curtain, on dry land and with less chocolate, and settled in at Washington University in St. Louis, Gamow turned his attention to cosmology. With critical assistance from his phenomenally talented graduate student Ralph Alpher, Gamow's research resulted in a far more detailed and vivid picture of the universe's earliest moments than had been revealed by the earlier work of Friedmann, who had been Gamow's teacher back in Leningrad and Lemaître. With a little modern updating, Gamow and Alpher's picture looks like this. Just after its birth, the stupendously hot and dense universe experienced a frenzy of activity. Space rapidly expanded and cooled, allowing a particle stew to congeal from the primordial plasma. For the first 3 minutes, the rapidly falling temperature remained sufficiently high for the universe to act like a cosmic nuclear furnace, synthesizing the simplest atomic nuclei, hydrogen, helium, and trace amounts of lithium. But with the passing of just a few more minutes, the temperature dropped to about 10 to the 8 Kelvin, roughly 10,000 times the surface temperature of the sun. Although immensely high by everyday standards, this temperature was too low to support further nuclear processes, and so from this time on, the particle commotion largely abated. For eons that followed, not much happened except that space kept expanding, and the particle bath kept cooling. Then, some 370,000 years later, when the universe had cooled to about 3,000 Kelvin, half the sun's surface temperature, the cosmic monotony was interrupted by a pivotal turn of events. To that point, space had been filled with a plasma of particles carrying electric charge, mostly protons and electrons. Because electrically charged particles have the unique ability to jostle photons, particles of light, the primordial plasma would have appeared opaque. The photons, incessantly buffeted by electrons and protons, would have provided a diffuse glow similar to a car's high beams cloaked by a dense fog. But when the temperature dropped below 3000 Kelvin, the rapidly moving electrons and nuclei slowed sufficiently to amalgamate into atoms. Electrons were captured by the atomic nuclei and drawn into orbit. This was a key transformation. Because protons and electrons have equal but opposite charges, their atomic unions are electrically neutral. And since a plasma of electrically neutral composites allows photons to slip through like a hot knife through butter, the formation of atoms allowed the cosmic fog to clear and the luminous echo of the Big Bang to be released. The primordial photons have been streaming through space ever since. Well, with one important caveat. Although no longer knocked to and fro by electrically charged particles, the photons have been subject to one other important influence. As space expands, things dilute and cool, including photons. But unlike particles of matter, photons don't slow down when they cool. Being particles of light, they always travel at light speed. Instead, when photons cool, their vibrational frequencies decrease, which means they change color. Violet photons will shift to blue, then to green, to yellow, to red, and then into the infrared, like those visible with night goggles, the microwave, like those that heat food by bouncing around your microwave oven, and finally into the domain of radio frequencies. As Gamow first realized, and as Alpha and his collaborator Robert Hermann worked out with greater fidelity, all this means that if the Big Bang theory is correct, then space everywhere should now be filled with remnant photons from the creation event, streaming every which way, whose vibrational frequencies are determined by how much the universe has expanded and cooled during the billions of years since they were released. Detailed mathematical calculations show that the photons should have cooled close to absolute zero, placing their frequencies in the microwave part of the spectrum. For this reason, they are called the cosmic microwave background radiation. I recently reread the papers of Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann that in the late 1940s announced and explained these conclusions. They are marvels of theoretical physics. The technical analyses involved require hardly more than a grounding in undergraduate physics, and yet the results are profound. The authors concluded that we are all immersed in a bath of photons, a cosmic heirloom bequeathed to us by the universe's fiery birth. With that buildup, you may find it surprising that the papers were ignored. This was mostly because they were written during an era dominated by quantum and nuclear physics. Cosmology had yet to make its mark as a quantitative science, so the physics culture was less receptive to what seemed like fringe theoretical studies. To some degree, the papers also languished because of Gamow's unusually playful style. He once modified the authorship of a paper he was writing with Alpher to include his friend, the future Nobel laureate Hans Bethe, just to make the paper's byline, Alpher, Bethe, Gamow, sound like the first three letters of the Greek alphabet, which resulted in some physicists taking him less seriously than he deserved. Try as they might, Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann could not interest anyone in the results, let alone persuade astronomers to devote the significant effort required to attempt detection of the relic radiation they predicted. The papers were quickly forgotten. In the early 1960s, unaware of the earlier work, the Princeton physicists Robert Dickey and Jim Peebles went down a similar path and also realized that the Big Bang's legacy should be the presence of a ubiquitous background radiation filling space. Unlike the members of Gamow's team, however, Dickey was a renowned experimentalist and so didn't need to persuade anyone to seek the radiation observationally. He could do it himself. Together with his students David Wilkinson and Peter Roll, Dickey devised an experimental scheme to capture some of the Big Bang's vestigial photons. But before the Princeton researchers could put their plan to the test, they received one of the most famous phone calls in the history of science. While Dickey and Peebles had been calculating, the physicists Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson at Bell Labs, less than 30 miles from Princeton, had been struggling with a radio communications antenna. No matter what adjustments they made, the antenna hissed with a steady, unavoidable background noise. Penzias and Wilson were convinced that something was wrong with their equipment. But then came a serendipitous chain of conversations. It began with a talk Peebles gave in February 1965 at Johns Hopkins University, which was attended by the Carnegie Institution radio astronomer Kenneth Turner, who mentioned the results he heard Peebles present to his MIT colleague Bernard Burke, who happened to be in touch with Penzias at Bell Labs. Hearing of the Princeton research, the Bell Labs team realized that their antenna was hissing for good reason. It was picking up the cosmic microwave background radiation. Penzias and Wilson called Dickey, who quickly confirmed that they had unintentionally tapped into the reverberation of the Big Bang. The two groups agreed to publish their paper simultaneously in the prestigious Astrophysical Journal. The Princeton group discussed their theory of the background radiation's cosmological origin, while the Bell Labs team reported, in the most conservative of language with no mention of cosmology, the detection of uniform microwave radiation permeating space. Neither paper mentioned the earlier work of Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann. For their discovery, Penzias and Wilson were awarded the 1978 Nobel Prize in Physics. Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann were deeply dismayed, and in the years that followed struggled mightily to have their work recognized. Only gradually and belatedly has the physics community saluted their primary role in this monumental discovery. The uncanny uniformity of ancient photons. During the decades since it was first observed, the cosmic microwave background radiation has become a crucial tool in cosmological investigations. The reason is clear. In a great many fields, researchers would give their eye teeth to have an unfettered, direct glimpse of the past. Instead, they generally have to piece together a view of remote conditions on the basis of evidence from remnants, weathered fossils, decaying parchments, or mummified remains. Cosmology is the one field in which we can actually witness history. The pinpoints of starlight we can see with the naked eye are streams of photons that have been traveling toward us for a few years or a few thousand. The light from more distant objects, captured by powerful telescopes, has been traveling toward us far longer, sometimes for billions of years. When you look at such ancient light, you are seeing, literally, ancient times. Those primeval comings and goings transpired far away, but the apparent large-scale uniformity of the universe argues strongly that what was happening there was also, on average, happening here. In looking up, we are looking back. The cosmic microwave photons allow us to make the most of this opportunity. No matter how technology may improve, the microwave photons are the oldest we can hope to see, because their elder brethren were trapped by the foggy conditions that prevailed during earlier epochs. When we examine the cosmic microwave background photons, we are glimpsing how things were nearly 14 billion years ago. Calculations show that today, there are about 400 million of these cosmic microwave photons racing through every cubic meter of space. Although our eyes can't see them, an old-fashioned television set can. About 1% of the snow on a television that's been disconnected from the cable signal and tuned to a station that ceased broadcasting is due to the reception of the Big Bang's photons. It's a curious thought. The very same airwaves that carry reruns of All in the Family and The Honeymooners are infused with some of the universe's oldest fossils, photons communicating a drama that played out when the cosmos was but a few hundred thousand years old. The Big Bang model's correct prediction that space would be filled with microwave background radiation was a triumph. During a mere 300 years of scientific thought and technological progress, our species went from peering through rudimentary telescopes and dropping balls from leaning towers to grasping physical processes at work just after the universe was born. Nevertheless, further investigation of the data raised a pointed challenge. Ever more refined measurements of the radiation's temperature, made not with television sets, but with some of the most precise astronomical equipment ever built, show that the radiation is thoroughly, uncannily, uniform across space. Regardless of where you point your detector, the temperature of the radiation is 2.725 degrees above absolute zero. The puzzle is to explain how such fantastic uniformity came to be. Given the ideas presented in Chapter 2, I can imagine you're saying, well, that's just the cosmological principle at work. No location in the universe is special when compared with any other, so the temperature at each should be the same. Fair enough. But remember that the cosmological principle was a simplifying assumption that physicists, including Einstein, invoked to make the mathematical analysis of the universe's evolution tractable. Since the microwave background radiation is indeed uniform throughout space, it provides convincing observational evidence for the cosmological principle, and it strengthens our confidence in conclusions the principle helped reveal. But the radiation's astounding uniformity shines a glaring spotlight on the cosmological principle itself. Reasonable though the cosmological principle may sound, what mechanism established the cosmos-wide uniformity that observations confirm? Faster than the speed of light. We've all had that mildly unsettling sensation of shaking someone's hand and finding it steamy hot, not so bad, or clammy cold, definitely worse. But were you to hold on to that hand, you'd find that the modest temperature differential would quickly subside. When objects are in contact, heat migrates from the hotter to the colder until their temperatures are equal. You experience this all the time. It's why coffee left on your desk eventually comes to room temperature. Similar reasoning would seem to explain the uniformity of the microwave background radiation. As with holding hands and standing coffee, the uniformity presumably reflects the familiar reversion of an environment to an overall common temperature. The sole novelty of the process is that the reversion is supposed to have taken place over cosmic distances. In the Big Bang theory, however, the explanation fails. For places or things to reach a common temperature, an essential condition is mutual contact. It may be direct, as with shaking hands, or minimally through an exchange of information so that conditions at distinct locations can become correlated. Only through such mutual influence can a shared communal environment be achieved. A thermos is designed to prevent such interactions, thwarting the drive to uniformity and preserving temperature differences. This simple observation highlights the problem with the naive explanation of the cosmic temperature uniformity. Locations in space that are very far apart, say, one point way off to your right, so deep in the night sky that the first light it ever emitted has only just reached you, and a second similar point way off to your left, have never interacted. Although you can see both, light from one still has an enormous distance to cover before it reaches the other. Thus, hypothetical observers situated at the distant left and right locations have yet to see each other, and since the speed of light sets the upper limit for how fast anything can travel, they've yet to interact in any way. To use the language of the previous chapter, they are beyond each other's cosmic horizon. This description makes the mystery manifest. You'd be floored if inhabitants of these distant locations spoke the same language and had libraries filled with the same books. With no contact, how could a common heritage have been established? You should be equally floored to learn that without any apparent contact, these widely separated regions share a common temperature, one that matches to an accuracy of better than 4 decimal places. Years ago, when I first learned of this puzzle, I was floored. But on further thought, I became puzzled by the puzzle. How could two objects that were once close together, as we believe all things in the observable universe were at the time of the Big Bang, have separated so quickly that light emitted by one wouldn't have time to reach the other? Light sets the cosmic speed limit, so how could the objects achieve a spatial separation greater than what light would have had time to traverse? The answer highlights a point that's often not adequately stressed. The speed limit set by light refers solely to the motion of objects through space. But galaxies recede from one another not because they are traveling through space, galaxies don't have jet engines, but rather because space itself is swelling and the galaxies are being dragged along by the overall flow. And the thing is, relativity places no limit on how fast space can swell, so there's no limit on how fast galaxies that are being pushed apart by the swell recede from one another. The rate of recession between any two galaxies can exceed any speed, including the speed of light. Indeed, the mathematics of general relativity shows that in the universe's earliest moments, space would have swelled so fast that regions would have been propelled apart at greater than light speed. As a result, they would have been unable to exert any influence on one another. The difficulty then is to explain how nearly identical temperatures were established in independent cosmic domains, a puzzle cosmologists have named the horizon problem. Broadening horizons. In 1979, Alan Guth, then working at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, came up with an idea that, with subsequent critical refinements made by André Linde, then carrying out research at the Lebedev Physical Institute in Moscow, and by Paul Steinhardt and Andreas Albrecht, a professor-student duo who were then working at the University of Pennsylvania, is widely believed to solve the horizon problem. The solution, inflationary cosmology, relies on some subtle features of Einstein's general relativity that I'll describe in a moment, but its broad outline can be readily summarized. The horizon problem afflicts the standard Big Bang theory because regions of space separate too quickly for thermal equality to be established. The inflationary theory resolves the problem by slowing the speed with which the regions were separating very early on, providing them ample time to come to the same temperature. The theory then proposes that after the completion of these cosmic handshakes, there came a brief burst of enormously fast and ever-quickening expansion, called inflationary expansion, which more than compensated for the sluggish start, rapidly driving the regions to vastly different positions in the sky. The uniform conditions we observe no longer pose a mystery, since a common temperature was established before the regions were rapidly driven apart. In broad strokes, that's the essence of the inflationary proposal. Bear in mind, however, that physicists don't dictate how the universe expands. As far as we can tell from our most refined observations, Einstein's equations of general relativity do. The viability of the inflationary scenario thus depends on whether its proposed modification to the standard Big Bang expansion can emerge from Einstein's mathematics. At first glance, this is far from obvious. For example, I'm pretty sure that if you were to bring Newton up to date by giving him a 5-minute primer on general relativity, explaining the outlines of warp space in the expanding universe, he'd find your subsequent description of the inflationary proposal preposterous. Newton would sternly maintain that regardless of fancy math and newfangled Einsteinian language, gravity is still an attractive force. And so he would emphasize with a pound on the table, gravity acts to pull objects together, slowing any cosmic divergence. Expansion that starts out dawdling, then sharply quickens for a brief period, might solve the horizon problem, but it's a fiction. Newton would declare that just as gravitational attraction implies that the speed of a batted baseball diminishes as the ball moves upward, it similarly implies that the cosmic expansion must slow over time. Sure, if the expansion drops all the way to zero and then turns into cosmic contraction, the implosion can speed up over time, much as the ball's speed can increase when it starts its downward journey. But the speed of the outward spatial expansion can't increase. Newton's making a mistake, but you can't blame him. The burden lies with the cursory summary you gave him of general relativity. Don't get me wrong, it's understandable that, given only 5 minutes, one of which was spent explaining baseball, you focused on curved space-time as the source of gravity. Newton himself had called attention to the fact that there was no known mechanism for transmitting gravity, and he always viewed that as a yawning hole in his own theory. Naturally, you wanted to show him Einstein's resolution. But Einstein's theory of gravity did much more than merely fill a gap in Newtonian physics. Gravity in general relativity differs in its essence from gravity in Newton's physics, and in the present context, there's one feature that cries out for emphasis. In Newton's theory, gravity arises solely from an object's mass. The bigger the mass, the bigger the object's gravitational pull. In Einstein's theory, gravity arises from an object's mass and energy, but also from its pressure. Weigh a sealed bag of potato chips. Weigh it again, but this time squeeze the bag so that the air inside is under higher pressure. According to Newton, the weight will be the same because there's been no change in mass. According to Einstein, the squeezed bag will weigh slightly more because although the mass is the same, there's been an increase in pressure. In everyday circumstances, we're not aware of it, because for ordinary objects, the effect is fantastically tiny. Even so, general relativity and the experiments that have shown it to be correct makes it perfectly clear that pressure contributes to gravity. This deviation from Newton's theory is critical. Air pressure, whether the air is in a bag of potato chips, an inflated balloon, or the room where you're now reading, is positive, meaning that the air pushes outward. In general relativity, positive pressure, like positive mass, contributes positively to gravity, resulting in increased weight. But whereas mass is always positive, there are situations in which pressure can be negative. Think of a stretched rubber band. Rather than pushing outward, the rubber band's straining molecules pull inward, exerting what physicists call negative pressure, or equivalently, tension. And much as general relativity shows that positive pressure gives rise to attractive gravity, it shows that negative pressure gives rise to the opposite, repulsive gravity. Repulsive gravity? This would blow Newton's mind. For him, gravity was only attractive. But your mind should remain intact. You've already encountered this strange clause in general relativity's contract with gravity. Remember Einstein's cosmological constant discussed in the previous chapter? I declared there that by infusing space with a uniform energy, a cosmological constant generates repulsive gravity. But in that earlier encounter, I didn't explain why this happens. Now I can. A cosmological constant not only endows the spatial fabric with a uniform energy determined by the constant's value, the number on the third line of the apocryphal relativity tax form, but it also fills space with a uniform negative pressure. We'll see why in a moment. And as above, when it comes to the gravitational force each produces, negative pressure does the opposite of positive mass and positive pressure. It yields repulsive gravity. In Einstein's hands, repulsive gravity was used for a single erroneous purpose. He proposed finely adjusting the amount of negative pressure that permeates space to ensure that the repulsive gravity produced would exactly counter the attractive gravity exerted by the universe's more familiar material contents, yielding a static universe. As we've seen, he subsequently renounced this move. 6 decades later, the developers of the inflationary theory proposed a kind of repulsive gravity that differed from Einstein's version much as the finale of Mahler's Eighth differs from the drone of a tuning fork. Rather than a moderate and steady outward push that would stabilize the universe, the inflationary theory envisions a gargantuan surge of repulsive gravity that's astoundingly short and thunderingly intense. Regions of space had ample time before the burst to come to the same temperature, but then, riding the surge, covered the great distances necessary to reach their observed positions in the sky. At this point, Newton would surely shoot you another disapproving look. Ever the skeptic, he would find another problem with your explanation. After catching up on the more intricate details of general relativity by racing through one of the standard textbooks, he would accept the strange fact that gravity can, in principle, be repulsive. But he'd ask, what's all this talk of negative pressure permeating space? It's one thing to use the inward pull of a stretched rubber band as an example of negative pressure. It's another to argue that billions of years ago, just around the time of the Big Bang, space was momentarily permeated by an enormous and uniform negative pressure. What thing or process or entity has the capacity to supply such a fleeting but pervasive negative pressure? The genius of inflation's pioneers was to provide an answer. They showed that the negative pressure required for an anti-gravity burst naturally emerges from a novel mechanism involving ingredients known as quantum fields. For our story, the details are crucial because the manner in which inflationary expansion comes about is central to the version of parallel universes it yields. Quantum fields. In Newton's day, physics concerned itself with the motion of objects you can see, stones, cannonballs, planets, and the equations he developed closely reflected this focus. Newton's laws of motion are a mathematical embodiment of how such tangible bodies move when they're pushed, pulled, or shot through the air. For more than a century, this was a wonderfully fruitful approach. But in the early 1800s, the English scientist Michael Faraday initiated a transformation in thinking with the elusive but demonstrably powerful concept of the field. Take a strong refrigerator magnet and place it an inch above a paperclip. You know what happens. The clip jumps up and sticks to the magnet surface. This demonstration is so commonplace, so thoroughly familiar, that it's easy to overlook how bizarre it is. Without touching the paperclip, the magnet can make it move. How is this possible? How can an influence be exerted in the absence of any contact with the clip itself? These and a multitude of related considerations led Faraday to postulate that though the magnet proper does not touch the paperclip, the magnet produces something that does. That something is what Faraday called a magnetic field. We can't see the fields produced by magnets. We can't hear them. None of our senses are attuned to them. But that reflects physiological limitations, nothing more. As a flame generates heat, so a magnet generates a magnetic field. Lying beyond the physical boundary of the solid magnet, the magnet's field is a mist or essence that fills space and does the magnet's bidding. Magnetic fields are but one kind of field. Charged particles give rise to another, electric fields, such as those responsible for the shock you sometimes receive when you reach for a metal doorknob in a room with wall-to-wall wool carpeting. Unexpectedly, Faraday's experiment showed that electric and magnetic fields are intimately related. He found that a changing electric field generates a magnetic field, and vice versa. In the late 1800s, James Clerk Maxwell put mathematical might behind these insights, describing electric and magnetic fields in terms of numbers assigned to each point in space. The numbers' values reflect the field's ability at that location to exert influence. Places in space where the magnetic field's numerical value are large, for instance, an MRI's cavity, are places where metal objects will feel a strong push or pull. Places in space where the electric field's numerical values are large, for instance, the inside of a thundercloud, are places where powerful electrical discharges, such as lightning, may occur. Maxwell discovered equations, which now bear his name, that govern how the strength of the electric and magnetic fields varies from point to point in space and moment to moment in time. These very same equations govern the sea of rippling electric and magnetic fields, so-called electromagnetic waves, within which we are all immersed. Turn on a cell phone, a radio, or a wireless computer, and the signals received represent a tiny portion of the thicket of electromagnetic transmissions silently rushing by and through you every second. Most stunning of all, Maxwell's equations revealed that visible light itself is an electromagnetic wave, one whose rippling patterns our eyes have evolved to see. In the second half of the 20th century, physicists united the field concept with their burgeoning understanding of the microworld encapsulated by quantum mechanics. The result? quantum field theory provides a mathematical framework for our most refined theories of matter and nature's forces. Using it, physicists have established that in addition to electric and magnetic fields, there exists a whole panoply of others with names like strong and weak nuclear fields and electron, quark, and neutrino fields. One field that to date remains wholly hypothetical, the inflaton field, provides a theoretical basis for inflationary cosmology. Quantum fields and inflation. Fields carry energy. Qualitatively, we know this because fields accomplish tasks that require energy, such as causing objects, like paper clips, to move. Quantitatively, the equations of quantum field theory show us how, given the numerical value of a field at a particular location, to calculate the amount of energy it contains. Typically, the larger the value, the larger the energy. A field's value can vary from place to place, but should it be constant, taking the same value everywhere, it would fill space with the same energy at every point. Guth's critical insight was that such uniform field configurations fill space not only with uniform energy, but also with uniform negative pressure. And with that, he found a physical mechanism to generate repulsive gravity. To see why a uniform field yields negative pressure, think first about a more ordinary situation that involves positive pressure, the opening of a bottle of Dom Perignon. As you slowly remove the cork, you can feel the positive pressure of the champagne's carbon dioxide pushing outward, driving the cork from the bottle and into your hand. A fact you can directly verify is that this outward exertion drains a little energy from the champagne. You know those vapor tendrils you see near the bottle's neck when the cork is out? They form because the energy expended by the champagne in pushing against the cork results in a drop in temperature, which, much as with your breath on a wintry day, causes surrounding water vapor to condense. Now imagine replacing the champagne with something less festive but more pedagogical, a field whose value is uniform throughout the bottle. When you remove the cork this time, your experience will be very different. As you slide the cork outward, you make a little extra volume inside the bottle available for the field to permeate. Since a uniform field contributes the same energy at every location, the larger the volume the field fills, the greater the total energy the bottle contains. Which means that, unlike with champagne, the act of removing the cork adds energy to the bottle. How could that be? Where would the energy come from? Well, think about what happens if the bottle's contents, rather than pushing the cork outward, pull the cork inward. This would require you to pull on the cork to remove it, an exertion of effort that in turn would transfer energy from your muscles to the contents of the bottle. To explain the increase in the bottle's energy, we thus conclude that, unlike champagne, which pushes outward, a uniform field sucks inward. That's what we mean by uniform fields resulting in a negative, not positive, pressure. Although there's no sommelier uncorking the cosmos, the same conclusion holds. If there's a field, the hypothetical inflaton field, that has a uniform value throughout a region of space, it will fill that region not only with energy, but also with negative pressure. And as is now familiar, such negative pressure yields repulsive gravity, which drives an ever-quickening expansion of space. When Guth slotted into Einstein's equations the likely numerical values for the inflaton's energy and pressure, consonant with the extreme environment of the very early universe, the mathematics revealed that the resulting repulsive gravity would be stupendous. It would easily be many orders of magnitude stronger than the repulsive force